might not remember that a lady doesn't go around lopping the heads off of random folks, you goddamn yellow-bellied jackass. I turn and walk back to the wall, climbing it easily this time. A few feet away, Alphonse stands, open-mouthed, waiting for me. I give him a long look. Don't say a word. He nods, and we pick back up where we left off, walking up and down our portion of the wall. The moans of the shamblers seem farther away now, like they've lost interest now that fresh meat isn't in the immediate vicinity. Inside, my thoughts churn. This can't be the first time Bill has shot an innocent person out of fear. Do we truly mean so little around here? I laugh mirthlessly at the obviousness of the answer. Maisie, and the other girl, the one I didn't know. It wasn't an accident that she ended up in a field full of shamblers. Maisie was always top-notch when I knew her. There's no way she got bit during a routine patrol. So how did she turn? I ain't sure I want to know. As I walk the wall for the remainder of the day, one thing becomes clear. There is no such thing as the good life in Summerland for Negroes. The only thing here for us is death, whatever form that might take. I'm sending along some money for a new dress. The tobacco this year did very well, as did the tomatoes. Of course, the tobacco fetched a far better price. It's amazing that even in the twilight of the apocalypse, people are willing to pay a premium for their vices. I'm thinking of buying the Parker's old homestead and using the fields for additional corn for the whiskey, since our small distillery has become quite popular. One of the field hands, a big man named Kingston, says he knows a thing or two about running a still, and I think he might be able to take on the additional work since our own still is so very small. I feel this would be an excellent way to ensure Rose Hill's financial stability. I will not have you return to a hovel. Chapter 24, in which some time passes and I grow restless. Every day is just like that first day. We run out to some place along the wall, grab breakfast, run some more, the rotations decided upon by the sheriff and his men. Once there, the fence team checks out the interior fences while the patrols walk the wall, watching the shamblers boil and froth beneath us. I get the feeling there are other groups of boys and girls doing this same task at different times of the day. But the sheriff is careful to keep us separated, and I only see the 20 or so girls and boys who make up my group. I ain't paired with Alphonse for every patrol, and the ever-changing roster of partners is mind-numbing. Sometimes I walk the wall with Ida, who tries her damnedest to draw me into conversation to no avail. Sometimes I walk with one of the other girls or one of the boys. Our job is simple. Walk along the wall, make sure the shamblers don't get too intrepid, and climb over. The rotting remains of dozens of shamblers line the lee side of the wall, including the ones I put down my first day. And no matter how much time I spend on the berm, I never get used to the smell. It is a foul task the sheriff has set us to, and I ain't sure why we ain't allowed to harvest the whole lot of them. The only possible joy in my life now is putting down shamblers. But I'm denied even that bit of relief except in the rare case where a shambler decides to test out the wall. It quickly becomes clear that the idea of a single shambler climbing the spare handholds and making it to the top is a ridiculous one. But we're still permitted to swing down and harvest any that tries, for which I'm thankful. I keep my sword, and Alphonse must say something to the rest of the patrol team about what happened on the first day, because no one makes a move to snatch it from the shed where we put our tools at the end of the day. No matter how long I take to get into the weapons shed, the sword is always right there where I left it. I managed to make it passable sharp as I walked the wall, using a decent rock and a lot of spit. It still needs oil, and it's nowhere as good as my sickles back home. But it's better than anything else, and I'm glad for it. In the evening, we run back, eat dinner, go to church, whether we care to or not. The sermons are all about as inspiring as that first one. And go to bed. On Tuesday, nearly a week since we got to Summerland, we collect our meager pay. Most folks immediately take to the general store, a line of dark faces lining up out front waiting to spend their money. The colored folks ain't all that different from the white working class folks, since Tuesday is payday for the cowpokes as well, and they're all up in the saloon spending what little they got. The only change is Bob and Bill standing near the line of colored shoppers, only too happy to use their rifles if anyone should get out of hand. After what I saw my first day at the wall, I have no doubt they would. I watched the line, noting a few unfamiliar faces, older folks I don't recognize. They most likely work and live in the nicer side of town with the fancy houses. That must be where they're keeping Lily and the Spencers and Catherine. I'm sure Catherine is fine. She's too contrary to be anything else. But I'm desperate to get to Lily and see if she's okay. I can't leave town without the two of them in tow, so until I can find them, I'm trapped here. I'm also anxious about Jackson. I haven't seen him since the day we arrived, and after witnessing Bill's icky trigger finger, I fear the worst. But I've heard no news of him being killed, so I nursed the tiny ember of hope the same way I nurture my rage. I don't go to the general store, even though I'm hungry and could do for some extra chow. I take my money to the Duchess for a bath, clean clothes, and to see if one of her girls can braid up my hair. The light-skinned Negro girl I saw perched up the bar on the first day, Nessie, comes into the bathing room while I sit in the rapidly cooling bath, weaving my hair into rows so tight it makes my eyes water.
Why didn't you go and spend your money at the general store, like everyone else?
I shrug. I will at some point. I'd rather have clean blankets and clothes for now. Nessie laughs, the sound high and lilting.
You're the only one. You're smart to stay away from the general store, though. You go there, your pocket's empty real fast. They got the prices so high, even the penny whistle costs 2 bits.
After Nessie finishes braiding my hair throbbing because of her braiding skill, I finally ask the question that's been plaguing me all week. How'd you end up in the cat house? All the other girls are white. She ducks her head and shakes it.
Ah, well, the sheriff, he took a liking to me back when I first got here. If you haven't noticed, he's kind of a sucker for a pretty face. Offered for me to work for the Duchess instead of marching out among the dead.
She looks embarrassed, tugging at the low front of her dress, trying without success to pull it up.
It don't matter much anyway now. But I was never any good at taking down shamblers. I always got stuck wondering who they'd been before. And after the last big massacre, before the wall was finished, well, I didn't have the stomach for it. I would have just gotten someone killed out on the line.
She goes quiet for a while, the sound of her breathing the only clue she's still behind me.
Whoring ain't so bad once you get used to it. Just ask the other girls. Most of the men are okay. The sheriff's boys can get rough, though.
I nod, feeling like a lout for asking such a personal question. She offers me a hand mirror to check her work. I turn my head from side to side before pointing to my hair.
Thank you.
She smiles wide, the shadows of shame fleeing her face.
Not a problem. Let me know if you'd like me to do it for you again. I'll have the Duchess give you a discount. You got good hair, not as thick as some of these other girls.
My lips quirk. Auntie Aggie used to always say that about my hair as well.
It makes me homesick for Rose Hill. The ache so bad that I nearly cry. Later, I lie on my blankets, still damp from being laundered, and reread my letters from Mama for the millionth time. The night sky out here in Kansas is somehow plenty bright to read, and as always, a kind of pain blooms in my chest. Part homesick and part grief. The last letter is from nearly a year ago, and in it, Mama plaintively wonders why I haven't written. I think of all my letters, all those memories and clever anecdotes gone into the ether. I know Red Jack posted them for me, but if the postmaster never forwarded them, then they never went. What happened to those letters anyway? Did Miss Anderson read them and laugh at my girlish sentiment? Or did she snatch them up and burn them? I imagine Miss Anderson tossing the letters into the fireplace, her hatchet face smiling evilly, and a white-hot rage seizes me so firmly that I'm half afraid I might murder someone just to watch them die. I take deep breaths, pushing the rage aside, plotting instead of giving way. I've been in Summerland for a week, and I still got no idea how to get myself back east to Baltimore and Rose Hill. It seems like an overwhelming task, a mountain of adversity, separated from what few friends I have and a plane full of shamblers between me and where I want to be. I doze in fits and starts, my near-empty belly and discontent stronger than my fatigue. Eventually, I wake. I need to move, to go somewhere of my own free will. Otherwise, I'm going to explode in an ugly way. The feeling roiling around in my chest reminds me of the night the Major tried to kill me, his hand tight around my throat, fear and hopelessness and rage warring deep within my being. That was the third time a person tried to murder me. It was the night before the Major turned shambler. He'd come in to visit Mama. It was late, and his footfalls were heavy as he climbed the stairs in a whiskey-fueled haze. He slammed the door open loud enough that even the aunties sleeping in the kitchen had heard the crash. Mama, for her part, was unperturbed. She was busy reciting a bit of Shakespeare, The Tempest, to be exact, when he walked in. I hadn't been able to figure out why she wanted to read at such a late hour, but one glance at the Major's bleary-eyed glare, and I had an inkling.
"Pet and I are reading, Jonas."
Mama never called me Jane in front of the Major. Her own grandmother's name had been Jane, and perhaps she feared that the coincidence would be enough to make the Major peer more closely at my features, to compare my stubborn chin and narrow nose to Mama's own features.
"You're my wife," he slurred. "I demand you fulfill your duties."
"Your belly is full, your estate is safe and prosperous, and you're drunk on whiskey from my own still. I'd say I've done more than enough to fulfill my duties." For a moment the air was heavy with tension, and I huddled closer to Mama, fearful of what was about to happen. The Major laughed, a bitter sound, before crossing the room and snatching me up by the back of my head and dragging me across the bed so that he could grab me by the throat. He lifted me up effortlessly, his large fingers wrapped around my neck.
"I am the master here, you ungrateful bitch. I tell you when enough is enough."
He then squeezed, slowly choking me, pressing so hard that I saw spots. I clawed at his hand, but I was little, and nothing I did seemed to make much difference. That was when Mama stood up and slammed the complete works of William Shakespeare into the side of the Major's head. His grip immediately went slack, and I crashed to the ground, sobbing as I was finally able to breathe again.
"Jane, go down to the kitchens and tell Auntie Aggie that you need to stay out of sight for a few days, okay? I nodded, hot tears running down my face, and I ran down the stairs as quickly as I could. Auntie Aggie was waiting for me, and she hurried me back to her room, tucking me into bed next to her and whispering kind words as I cried myself to sleep. The next night, the major turned shambler, and that was the end of him. Now I climb out of bed in the dark, grabbing my boots, carrying them so I can put them on once I'm outside. I can't stay here, suffocated by my thoughts, choking on my dark memories. I need a moment of freedom, no matter how fleeting it may be. From below come the sounds of merriment, men shouting and women laughing. Payday has been the loudest night yet, no surprise there. I ain't sure what time it is, but apparently the party never ends, despite Sheriff Snyder's alleged curfew. "Where you going?" someone whispers at me from the dark. I don't know anyone's voice well enough to be certain whose it is, but I'm guessing it's Ida. "Out."
"You can't. There's curfew. You leave and the sheriff and his boys will make an example of you."
I shrug, then realize that whoever it is can't see me in the dark. "Don't worry about me. I can deal with the consequences."
"Let the chicken head figure it out herself," someone else snaps, "and be quiet. The rest of this town may not care about getting a full night's rest, but I do."
The room settles down amid grumbling, and I go to the door to slip out. Only when I go to turn the knob, it doesn't move. At some point in the night, they locked us in. I don't even blink, just step carefully through the room, trying to get to the open window, making all attempts to keep my feet away from sleeping forms. I've almost made it out when a hand grabs my ankle.
"You should go back to bed,"
the deep voice mumbles blearily. The big girl on the team that mends the interior fences and the one that woke us up the first day, Cora. She always seems to be watching me, and I don't need a spotlight to know a snitch when I see one. I appreciate the concern, but I've had enough sleep. The hand ratchets down tighter.
"We don't cause trouble here, girlie. As long as we follow the rules, things are fine. So that means you go back to bed, or I'll put you there."
I cross my arms and consider my options. I could go back to the pile of blankets that passes for my bed and wait for morning to come, which by my estimation would be another few hours or so. But that means backing down from Cora. And I've seen her kind. She'll do everything the people in charge tell her to, even if that means she ends up broken and bloody. She's one of those people that never learned to breathe, never understood the true meaning of freedom. She's a dog, happy even with a cruel master. She eats her 3 squares and takes her bit of pocket change and happily wears the collar around her throat, because that's enough for her. But it ain't for me. So instead of meekly going along with her commands, I ready myself and say, "If you don't let me go, I'm going to break that arm of yours, and I'm afraid that would be a most unfortunate turn of events." The grip on my ankle tightens painfully, and Cora pulls my foot, unbalancing me and sending me crashing to the floor. It's exactly what I expected her to do. I swing my legs around, a whirlwind of motion, catching her in the face as she goes to stand and using my momentum to climb to my feet. I stand over her as she holds her face.
"You kicked me in my mouth," she says,
the words garbled. "I think you'll find it's better to just let me do as I please." She's smart enough to say nothing in response. I make my way to the window again, which has been left open to let in some semblance of a breeze. The night is dark and looming, heavy and warm. For a moment, I consider going back to my spot, lying down, and trying to get along with the status quo. But I ain't never listened to that little voice before, and I ain't about to start now. A quick jump, and I'm out on the roof. Before I can even look for a way down, a bright light a few hundred yards away catches my eye. At first, I think it's the sun coming up, but it's way too early for that. It's only then that I understand what I'm seeing. Electric lights. Dozens of them, lining the streets and dotting the houses on that luxury section on the southern side of Summerland. The lights shine soft but bright in the night fog, and it's more lovely and peaceful than anything I've seen in a long time. Maybe in my whole life. I know now why I've been able to read by what I thought was moonlight each night. But those lights ain't for me. I'm two stories up, and there doesn't appear to be any way down from here. Below me, a couple of cowpokes stumble out of the saloon, singing some song. The words too slurred to make much sense. An ugly feeling of hopelessness wells up in me, and I have to fight tears. I ain't giving up. No way, no how. Pulling on my boots, I walk to the edge of the roof. The next building is only a few feet away. It looks to be abandoned. The second floor windows covered in a thick layer of dirt. I try to remember what's on the first floor, but I come up blank. With a running start, I jump to the adjacent roof. The window is open a bit, so I jimmy it wider and climb in. I stop just inside of the window. Through the darkness comes the sound of someone breathing. I wait, letting my eyes adjust to the gloom. Lying in the bed, arms hanging over the side, is the tinkerer I met on the first day, Mr. Gideon. His pale skin glows in the little bit of moonlight, and I'm a bit scandalized to see that he's naked from the waist up. He's too tall for the bed he's in, and his feet hang off the side. He looks like a broken baby doll, half-dressed and tossed where he lies. There hasn't been much time for social visits, and I ain't seen him since I got here. I ain't sure if he's friendly or not. I remember the way he pointed that revolver at my head and decide that he's probably not someone I want to risk waking. I take a step backward to climb out the window, and my foot catches a squeaky board. The movement from the bed is explosive. Mr. Gideon sits up, and a pistol gleams in the low light, the business end pointed right at me. My heart pounds in my throat, and for the first time in my life, I wonder why I always leap before looking. But there ain't ever much time for regrets, so I swallow down my heart and raise my hands in surrender. You sure do like to point that thing in my head. Miss McKean? None other. What are you doing in my sleeping chamber? I take a deep breath and let it out. I feel like I'm about to jump right out of my skin, but I'm in no immediate danger. The penny under my shirt is warm. The view, what I can see of it with the moonlight coming in the window, is the nicest thing I've seen all week. Gideon is all slim muscles and interesting boy angles, and it's hard to formulate an answer. I suppose the proper answer is that I don't rightly know. The honest answer is that life in this place is untenable, and if I don't get out of here soon, something bad is going to happen. I think of my mama's warning about my temper, the temper I inherited from her. Do not let things get to you, Jane. Do not give in to your rage, she'd always say, her voice full of warning and a knowledge I was afraid to plumb. But now, that anger is building up, making me feel like I'm going to lose my mind. In here, with this boy I don't know, this is the calmest I've felt all week. The tinkerer puts his revolver away and gives me a wry smile.
Miss McKean, this is a place where terrible things happen more often than you know. Go back to bed before Sheriff Snyder discovers that you've gotten out.
I should leave. Should turn and go back to my crowded room. But I don't. Instead, I lean against the wall, bold as can be. You mind answering a few questions before I go? He crosses his arms, and I feel his regard more than see it.
You barge into a man's room in the wee hours of the night, where he pulls a gun on you and tells you to leave, and now you wonder if you might ask some questions?
You did put the gun away.
His chuckle echoes through the room. Well, then, how could I say no?
Why ain't we trying to thin out the dead that surround the settlement? Whole plain is full of them, and all we do is keep them off the wall. Sooner or later, they're going to be more than we can hold back. I figured the point of settling in a place like this would be that it was far away from the eastern cities, largely empty of people to turn shambler. The tinkerer sighs, running his hand through his hair, and I see the telltale glint of a bracelet on his wrist. I wonder if it was a gift from someone important. I ain't known many men to wear jewelry that wasn't a gift. That makes me wonder if he has a wife. And if he does, why ain't she here?
You're right, he says, not really answering my question. You met the drovers? Mean as a shambler and about as bright?
Yeah, I've seen them.
There aren't any cattle here in Summerland. The only thing they're driving are the undead, at the pastor's and sheriff's orders.
The revelation leaves my mouth dry, and my hands itch from my sickles. Why?
I can't tell you that. I've told you too much already.
I just stare at him. And a soft sigh comes from the bed, a creak as his weight shifts.
The last person I told ended up turned, and I'm not about to endanger another Miss Preston's girl.
I think of Maisie Carpenter, mouth gaping, hands grasping. You talking about Maisie? He starts, and that's all the answer I need. How'd she end up out there on the plane?
She asked questions too, he says, his voice heavy with unsaid things.
I cross my arms, chilled despite the warm night. What's up with the other side of Summerland? Those nice houses.
Where the well-to-do folks live? They have their own stores, paved roads. You've probably seen the path that leads to the side of town lined with electric street lamps.
I remember the sounds of children playing my first day here. And the sight of those lights, and nod. The professor has just confirmed what Ida told me. Now I need to hie myself over to that side of town and find Catherine and Lily. I scratch at my braids and ask, why are people coming out here in the first place?
Money, land, empty promises. A lot of the folks out here were facing prison sentences if they didn't go west. People like the Duchess and most of the roughnecks. The survivalists think if they can make a go of it out here in the middle of nowhere, then they'll win more people to their cause.
I'd say they were pretty popular already.
Looks can be deceiving. The survivalists have had trouble getting a foothold in the northern states. People up there are more solitary and still believe in the legacy of Lincoln.
I snort. And what exactly was that?
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
I shake my head, because it's the silliest thing I've ever heard. colored folks working with white folks, not just for them? Not in this lifetime.
Anyway, Mr. Gideon continues, yawning widely.
The idea is to make Summerland the city of the future.
Electric lights, running water, a wall that will keep the undead out. They provide safety, real safety. Then people will make their way here, and we can start to rebuild something solid.
You don't seem to believe that.
The survivalists are going about it all wrong. You can't force the Negro to bend to your whims. You have to convince him that you can offer him a better life. Slavery is finished. Trying to live in the past will get us nowhere but undead. That wall we built may seem fine, but it won't last forever. The dead are adaptable. It's just a matter of time before that barrier comes down.
I watch him for a long time, trying to decide what to think about him. I decide I mostly like him, despite him pointing a gun at me, twice. And I swear that ain't just the fluttering feelings I'm getting from seeing him lying in a bed half naked either.
You don't seem like you belong out here, Mr. Gideon.
I doubt that I do.
I grin. I know why I'm here. But who'd you tick off to get sent out here?
My father.
It's not a response I'm expecting, and any type of rejoinder dies on my tongue. I'm sorry.
Don't be. It's been a learning experience, one I never could have gotten at Harvard.
I tap out a rhythm on the wood behind me as I think. I nod and swallow before I ask my final question. I haven't seen Jackson all week, and his disappearance has been preying on my mind in a way I don't like. It's not that I have feelings for him, because I don't. It's that I'm worried about what it means that I haven't seen him in so long. I remember the girl and her wide, staring eyes. How easily Bill shot her. And I have the feeling that something equally bad happened to Jackson. There was a boy. He was thrown in a cell in the sheriff's headquarters after we arrived together last week. I don't suppose you know where he got to.
Mr. Gideon shakes his head. No. I didn't see him when I was last there, and I can tell you that the jail only has a couple of cells for a reason. No need for them, when we have a sheriff with a short temper and a penchant for watching folks turn.
The implications of his words hit me like a punch. I've heard of such folks. Deviants who believe that some kind of enlightenment exists in watching the moment a man becomes a monster. It doesn't surprise me that the sheriff would have such predilections. And I wonder if there ain't some more sinister truth to the story about the loss of the sheriff's sweet-tempered wife. But Jackson.
Mr. Gideon seems to realize that the boy in question was more to me than just someone on the same train I'd taken here.
I'm sorry, he says.
Tears spring to my eyes, and a great big wave of ugly feeling wells up. Okay, then. Thank you.
You're welcome, Miss McKean. I'm afraid that we're all prisoners here of one kind or another, for better or worse.
Oh, it's for worse, all right. Most definitely for worse. I slip back out of his window without saying goodnight, making my way back to the room by the light of Summerland, and with a heavy heart. It's much easier to get back into bed than it was to get out, and when I find my blankets, I roll onto my side and cry silent, angry tears, clutching my lucky penny. They killed Jackson. There's no doubt in my mind that he's dead. Just like Maisie Carpenter. He's probably somewhere out there on the plain, hungry and yellow-eyed,
a shell of the boy I once knew. I curl up into a ball, biting my fist to hide the sound of my sobs. I barely feel my teeth sink into my hand. I'm too focused on the agony of being torn in half, like something inside of me is being savagely ripped out. The one boy I was stupid enough to love is dead. I thought my heart broke when he told me he didn't love me, that we were better off alone than together. In a world where people are always being ripped away by the undead plague, I thought his words had destroyed my heart. I was wrong. This is what a broken heart feels like. Jane, I caution you to prudence. I hope you are reading your Bible and using the scripture to temper your emotions, to always keep a cool head about you. But if you do not find solace there, perhaps you should take up embroidery. I suppose it is obvious that I worry about you, a little girl all alone in the world. I worry too much. Chapter 25, in which I embrace my recklessness. After Mr. Gideon tells me of Jackson's demise, something in me breaks. Jackson might not have been mine, and it might be his fault that I'm stuck in Summerland in the first place. But I still loved him. I didn't want him dead, and knowing the sheriff and his boys could murder someone without so much as a how do you do, makes me despair at the chance I have to outsmart a bloodthirsty man like that. I should be coming up with a way out of Summerland, plotting and scheming, but I ain't. Instead, I'm just surviving. And barely at that. I'm weak. Moments after eating, my belly growls for more, demanding sustenance that ain't coming. It ain't that I'm working any more than I did when I was at Miss Preston's. It's that the sheriff don't feed us enough. The portions at breakfast keep getting smaller and smaller. And even dinner, the only normal-sized meal we get, is getting leaner by the day. It's all the new families in town. The more white folks arrive, the less food we get. They're quality, and they can't miss a meal, Ida says, running her finger across the surface of her empty plate before licking it. What do you mean? I ask. I've just finished my own stew and am barely restraining myself from licking the plate. Even the roughnecks are looking hungry and perturbed. Their rations have been cut as well, meaning that there really is a problem with the food. This ain't just another of the preacher's initiatives to reform the Negro. Ain't you been paying attention? There's been two trains of families in the past week. Fancy folks, all bedecked in finery. Before that, we used to get maybe one train a month, and never anyone wearing silk. Something's happening back east, but who knows what, Ida says. You better just hope they don't think about expanding the brothel. Otherwise, you're going to be out of a place to sleep. She casts a dark look across the room where the Duchess's girls are calling out to the table of roustabouts. I don't know why they bother. It's Thursday. Those fellas are already broke. They spend their money as fast as we do. There's more folks moving into the nice part of town, but we haven't gotten any new Negroes for the patrols. Something just doesn't add up. Maybe it's time to take a little trip. I think about it all that night and the next. I think about the other side of town as I push aside a girl to get my breakfast, a dark feeling welling up in my middle when she starts crying, just as hungry and desperate as the rest of us. I think about it as I watch a small pod of decrepit shamblers attempt to climb the wall, their hands digging uselessly into the dirt. My blade flashing in the sun as I slide down the exterior of the wall to take off their heads. I keep thinking about the other side of town until I can't stand it no more, kicking off my covers in the warm heat of the night. No more wallowing, it's high time I find my friends and get an idea of what's going on in this other side of town. There's an itch in my brain, a thought that needs to be scratched. But more than that, I need food. My stomach growls so loudly that I cannot stand it. And next to me, Ida is no better off, just as awake and miserable as me. I'm going to find some grub, I whispered to her over the soft snores of the girls around us. Ida props herself up on her elbow. It isn't safe, Jane. We're slowly starving to death, Ida. We won't survive long on what we're getting. We can either die peacefully or survive by any means necessary. Ida purses her lips in the near dark before nodding. Be careful, she warns. I climb to my feet and grab my boots. Food and some answers, one or the other would be fine, but I'm greedy, so I'm hoping for both. I walk out on the roof and look for a legitimate way down this time. There's a small overhang off the western edge covering the boardwalk, and I'm thinking that if I can land on it, then I can ease myself to the ground from there and make my way to the other side of town. The only problem is that the overhang is almost directly across from the sheriff's office, so there's a chance I'll be seen if they're looking. It's not a risk I would take lightly. I debate going back to bed or trying something different once I've been able to make a proper plan. But then my stomach growls, so loud that I'm sure they heard it all the way back in Baltimore. I ain't waiting for an opportunity. I'm making one. I walk to the edge of the roof, dangling my feet off it and easing forward until I can jump. My landing is too loud and I throw myself flat on the overhang, breath held, waiting for someone to yell up at me. After a span of frantic heartbeats and slow breaths, I realize no one is coming for me, so I lower myself the rest of the way off of the overhang and take off at a sprint away from the buildings. It's dark, and I trip often. There ain't much light to see by, but the rich side of town glitters like a jewel in dung. It doesn't take me long to get there. In my haste, once I get close to the circle of light cast by the bright lamps that line the road, I can maneuver more quickly, using the shadows as my cover. That's when I realize there's a strange buzzing, like cicadas. At first I wonder why the bugs would be active this late at night, but then I realize it ain't cicadas. The sound is coming from the street lamps themselves. Must be the electricity coursing through them. I have no idea where the Spencers might live, but of 30 or so houses in this part of town, not many of them appear to be filled at this point. There are only a few on the street with lights on. Peeping in windows ain't ladylike, but it helps me to quickly assess who lives in what houses. The preacher sits in the study of one, reading some book, and I quickly duck away. I've soon looked in all the windows of the houses with lights on, and none of the folks I see are the Spencers or Catherine. But like Ida said, they're definitely quality. I recognize a couple of the folks from Mayor Carr's dinner party. It looks like his diabolical scheme is proceeding according to plan. If Catherine and Lily ain't to be seen, that leaves the houses that ain't lit up. So, like any desperate type, I start breaking into them. The first house is completely empty, still waiting for a family to move in. The second contains furniture, but no sign of people. The third, though, has pictures on the walls, ones I recognize from the night Jackson, Catherine, and I snuck into the Spencer's homestead. I'm in the right house. The click of a gun's hammer cocking back ain't good news, though. I put my hands up. Mr. Spencer, we've never met, but my name is Jane McKean. I turn around slowly. Only the rifle ain't held by Mr. Spencer. It's Lily, pointing the rifle at my face.
Jane McKean, she says, the barrel wavering just a little. The electric lamps from outside cast enough light that I can see her clearly. She wears a sleep shirt, and her hair is piled on top of her head. She's skinnier than I remember, but other than that, she looks fine. You better tell me why you're here, and my brother ain't.
I smile despite myself. Now here's the thing about Lily. She's a good girl, sweet as can be. But there's only one thing she cares about, and that's Jackson. You ain't never seen a brother and sister dote upon each other the way Lily and Jackson do. But that's where I have a problem. Even though I had nothing but love for Lily while Jackson and I went together, she had nothing but an abiding rage for me. There's not a lot of love for the girl who steals your brother away in a world where family is so fragile, where people lose each other daily. I understood it, even if I didn't much care for her attitude. After Jackson and I had parted ways, I think she'd developed a bit of a grudging respect for me. But that ain't going to matter if she thinks Jackson is in trouble and I had something to do with it, which is why there is no way in any of the seven hells that I'm going to tell her that her brother's likely turned shambler, especially not when she's pointing a rifle right at my face. They got him with the work detail, I say. It's the hardest fib I ever told. Mind putting a rifle down? She does, her reluctance visible. My brother know they got us living with shamblers over here? What are you talking about? I shake my head. Wait, start at the beginning. How did you and the Spencers end up here? Lily props the rifle on her shoulder and sighs, a sound that is far too grown up for her small frame.
The Spencers' crops didn't do so good last year, so Mr. Spencer was having trouble paying the mortgage in Baltimore County. He went to Mayor Carr to ask the man for a loan, and you know what Jackson says about borrowing money from rich people.
Borrow a dollar, pay with your soul, I say. It was how Jackson got locals to trust him instead of the banks, even though his rates were straight usury as well. Lily nods.
It so happened that Mr. Spencer couldn't pay when the mayor's men came to collect. So the mayor gave him a choice. He and his family could leave the county on their own. Or go west to this new settlement. You can guess which one Mr. Spencer picked. Before I could even get a note to my brother, we was on the train here.
So, the Spencers brought you here voluntarily. That must have been tough for you. Lily shrugs.
It's been mostly okay. A few of the families came here because they ain't got a lot of sense. They talk a lot about how the Negroes should be serving white folks, that we needed to reinstate that natural order the pastor is always going on about. That's why everyone is mad right now. The drovers they brought here to oversee the Negro patrols and fortify the border think the Negroes in your part of town should be taking all the risk to herd the dead, not them. Of course, Miss Catherine says everyone is right to be concerned, that this place ain't safe, no matter what kind of precautions we take.
Kate is here?
Yeah, she lives next door. She's the one that's got people to talking about safety and such. She's so pretty and smart. She's brilliant at smiling and saying a few words that gets everyone to thinking the way she does without them even knowing it. I want to be like her when I grow up.
I scowl. Figures. I'm starving and she's over here having tea parties and pontificating.
Anyway, Pastor Snyder says that the Lord will deliver us from hardship, but Miss Catherine says it's all a lie. And after what I seen, I'm scared, Jane. I don't know what's going to happen next.
Well, I've been out on the walls for a week now, and I don't want to make you feel any worse.
But I've seen one too many fresh shamblers to feel like these folks have the protections of Summerland figured out.
It ain't the walls or border patrols that concern me.
I blink. What are you scared of, then?
She sighs heavily.
Right.
Okay. Let me get my boots, and I'll show you.
She disappears and comes back carrying the rifle awkwardly and a pair of boots. She hands me the gun.
Just for a minute. That's mine.
Where'd you get it from? She pulls the boots on.
I won it, fair and square, from the Elkton boys up the street. I got a pair of boots out of it as well. You never seen a couple of stupider boys.
I grin. I always did like Lily.
But it's how I won it that caused this whole problem I've got, she continues. Come on.
We make our way outside, Lily leading the way. We've walked a little ways before it occurs to me to ask,
ain't you scared to be out this late by yourself? What will the Spencers say?
Lily snorts.
Nothing. Things have gone straight to hell since we got here.
She gives me a quick look.
Don't you dare tell my brother I swore.
Wouldn't think of it.
Anyway, soon after we arrived, things kind of fell apart. Mr. Spencer's been hitting the whiskey pretty hard and meeting in secret with folks who want to get rid of the sheriff. Mrs. Spencer's fallen into the laudanum.
What about the little ones?
The baby got the colic and passed right after we got here. It's just me and Thomas right now. We're getting by. Barely.
Her voice is heavy with emotion, and I realize that I ain't the only one who's had a hell of a time here in Summerland.
But what about the other families? Are they happy with the electric lights and the gourmet meals? These big houses?
Some of them are, sure. But if people feel a bit safer here than they did in Baltimore, it's only because they don't know what I know.
This whole town's got a rotten soul, Jane. Everything is built up on a house of cards that's going to come crashing down sooner or later.
What are you on about, Lily?
That's what I'm about to show you.
We stop in front of an unmarked building that looks rather like the Tinkerer's Lab. A sign on the door reads, Danger, Electric, Keep Out. There's a picture of a lightning bolt through the sign. I frown.
We're going in here?
I ain't, Lily says, a tremor in her voice.
The Elkton boys told me this place was haunted, that they heard strange noises coming from it at night. That's how I won my rifle. I went in on a double dog dare. I ain't never going down there again if I can help it.
But if you want answers, that's where they are. Before I can tell Lily thank you, she's heading back toward her house, head down, gait determined. For the first time in my life, I have a real regret. I should have told her about Jackson.
Well, there'll be time enough for sorries later, I hope.
Auntie Aggie worries about you, too. It's a cruel world with cruel people. I hope you haven't run afoul of too many of them. This world is a place that can eat a girl alive, even smart ones like you.
Chapter 26, in which I make a terrible mistake. The building isn't locked, and the door swings out on silent hinges. My heart pounds in my chest, and there is a part of me, the cowardly, yellow part, that urges me to turn around and scamper on back to bed. But there was too much nonsense in Lily's words, and my brain hates a mystery the way dogs hate cats. So before I can talk myself out of it, I'm descending the stairs. There ain't enough light to see properly, but I make my way, hands grazing the walls on either side of me to keep steady. The stairs ain't dirt like in Mr. Gideon's laboratory. They're wood. But everything else reminds me of my first day here. There ain't no electric lights, just good old kerosene lanterns set into a nook here and there. And I grab one to make my passage easier. At this point, my fear of getting caught is a faraway thing. I'm more keen on solving the mystery of the angry townsfolk than anything else. The stairs empty into a narrow hallway, and the scent of something powerful rotten hits me. I bury my face in the crook of my arm, the stink of me preferable to the stink of whatever's down here. I'm dog-tired and still too hungry to think straight, so it takes me a long moment before I realize exactly what it is I'm smelling. And the moment I do, that's when I hear the noises. Shamblers. I follow the scent of the dead, the sounds of the moans getting louder, and move cautiously down the tunnel. It ends in a large antechamber, nearly the size of a concert hall. I ain't sure who or what dug out such a large space, but it must have been a pretty impressive undertaking. The ceiling extends far above my head. The light cast down by a cluster of those same electric lamps, conspicuous in their constant glow. But I ain't nearly half as distracted by the lights as I am the sight that meets my eyes. Before me is a giant, rolling shambler cage. And in the cage, at least 50 shamblers running toward an old Negro man sitting in a chair, dozing. The shambler's turning the cage like a giant metal wheel. I ain't even got time for my normal fear response to rise up. I just watched the shambler's turning the entire mess in a circle, my brain trying to make sense of it all. I've heard lots of people suppose that shamblers could be useful for labor and such. I read the story of a man who hitched his plow to a team of shamblers and tried to use them to till his field. The problem was that they took off after his boy, catching the kid and eating him and a good part of the rest of his family before the entire clan set out for the local municipality and turned most of them as well. This was the problem with shamblers. One little slip, and everyone you knew was a ravenous monster. It didn't make much sense to do anything but put them down. Isn't it terrifying? I startle at the voice. The fear I couldn't feel at the sight of the shamblers finally making my heart jump painfully. Mr. Gideon walks out of the shadows, wiping his spectacles on a corner of his untucked shirt. He's unshaven, and the scruff of beard shadowing his cheeks makes him look tired and just a bit dangerous. It's an appealing look in a man, but I squash those soft feelings like bugs. I still ain't got the full measure of him, and if he thinks he's going to try something, I need to be ready for it.
Relax, Miss McKean. I'm not the one you need to fear.
Funny how the ones that turn on you always say something like that. A smile ghosts across his lips before disappearing.
True enough. Here, let me show you how this works.
What makes you think I care? He laughs a little.
You're smart. Your brain has been putting facts together since you got here, whether you realize it or not. And since you're here, you might as well learn every single last one of this town's terrible secrets.
He's right. A strong curiosity has always been one of my flaws. I nod, and my stomach chooses that moment to rumble loudly. My face heats and Mr. Gideon's eyes soften.
I do believe I may have some canned peaches somewhere down here as well. Follow me.
He walks toward the back of the room, past the giant shambler wheel. The dead in the cage stop walking for a moment, their yellow eyes fixating on us instead. But the cage has enough momentum that the few who are distracted lose their balance and fall down, their compatriots trampling them as the whole contraption keeps turning. One of the shamblers gets caught underfoot the wrong way, and its head is crushed by the others. It doesn't move after that. The body flopping at the bottom of the wheel while the whole thing keeps turning. I'm sure it's all some kind of metaphor. But I'm too tired and hungry to figure out what for. The rest of the fallen shamblers eventually regain their footing.